There was a guy with a turtleneck that came into our office, and it was in a room with no windows, no access to anybody. I was the only one with a key. He had chained the device to a table that couldn't move, and I wasn't supposed to show what I was working on to anyone, not even to talk about it with my husband. And about a few weeks after I finished it, it turns out that that's the app that got keynoted by Steve Jobs on stage, and all of a sudden Thomson Reuters got 30 million new users because they've decided to pre-install the app on iPads.
Welcome to Under Embargo, the podcast that says the quiet part out loud about PR, communications, and the chaos in between. Hosted by two of LinkedIn's most connected comms pros, Becca Chambers, a no-BS corporate comms exec with raging ADHD, and Parry Hedrick, founder of tech PR firm Crackle PR. This show brings it all. Real talk, sharp insights, and the kind of industry truths they don't put in press releases. No fluff, no filters, no f**ks given. This is Under Embargo. Let's get into it.
Welcome to the Under Embargo podcast. I am your host, Becca Chambers. I'm the CMO of Scale Venture Partners. My co-host, Parry Hedrick, who you will notice is absent today. So I'm doing this solo for the first time ever, although I have an excellent, I guess we can call Alina my co-host today, although she is also my guest. So no judgment of me trying to host the show alone, but I am super excited for today's guest. She has one of the most compelling founder journeys that I've heard, and I've actually heard a lot of founder journeys. So Alina Vandenberg is the co-founder and co-CEO of Chili Piper, and her path to building a very respected, one of the most respected names in revenue tech is pretty amazing. So I will dig into some of her background in the podcast, so no spoilers now. But Alina's been hustling since she was 8 years old. She's an immigrant with a master's in computer science, and she's had her apps featured by the likes of Steve Jobs himself. And she's founded a company with her husband, and they are now reimagining how B2B revenue teams are operating and solving really complicated business problems. And if you've been on LinkedIn for any amount of time, you're sure to have seen Alina there, because she's building a super authentic brand that I love. And that's how I found her and started following her. So I'm really happy to have her here. Welcome to Under Embargo.
Thank you, Becca. It feels a privilege for a nerd like me to be invited on a communication podcast.
Oh, no, it's my privilege. I'm so happy to have you here. Well, can I just have you kind of introduce yourself and Chili Piper and, you know, maybe just a little bit about your journey?
As you said, I started working ever since I can remember, and I didn't know that I wanted to become an entrepreneur, but I started working because I had to. And I thought my dream would be to climb the ladder in corporate America, which I did. I started working as an intern at Thomson Reuters, and I worked for Bloomberg and some other publicly traded company. And I realized that what I really love is building things. I wanted to see if I can start a company where I can just do that. So it's an ongoing experiment.
What was the first thing that you built?
When I started my first job here in America at Thomson Reuters, it was an application for news for Thomson Reuters on the iPad. It was before the iPad was launched. There was a guy with a turtleneck that came into our office, and it was in a room with no windows, no access to anybody. I was the only one with a key. He had chained the device to a table that couldn't move, and I wasn't supposed to show what I was working on to anyone, not even to talk about it with my husband. And about a few weeks after I finished it, it turns out that that's the app that got keynoted by Steve Jobs on stage, and all of a sudden Thomson Reuters got 30 million new users because they've decided to pre-install the app on iPads.
That is amazing. Okay, so I need to know more about this. So you were building it for the iPad, but you didn't really know that you were building it for the iPad. You just knew you were building it for this kind of secret thing. Did you know
it was a secret door?
Sorry, go ahead.
It was like in a metal chain, so I could see the device, but we didn't know the name of it. We didn't know what's going to happen to it. It was
as Apple always is, right? Everything is like super secretive. You had just kind of like working specs that you needed to work like with, right? To be able to create the thing.
Well, it was the beginning, right? So they didn't really have like guidelines for it. They didn't quite know what precisely the apps on it would look like, but we did have the iPhone as an example. And so it was somewhat easier imagining how to take that to a larger screen. But still, it was a lot of fun to kind of develop without much instruction. Yeah.
Yeah, that's super cool. And did you have any idea it was going to be on the stage, or was that a surprise?
No idea. No idea.
That's so cool.
It was definitely a surprise. Yeah.
What was your reaction when that happened?
Oh my gosh, I thought that I made it to America. You know, I was interviewed by the New York Times. We were in Times Square. The app was everywhere. I even have a picture of it. And I couldn't believe my luck. I could barely speak English, but here I was in New York Times, you know?
No, totally. Did that have like a profound impact on your career? Like just that moment kind of? Did that help launch you?
It gave me a lot of confidence for sure. If I could do this fast, what else did I have in me?
Totally. Wow, what a cool moment. So you are from Romania. How did you make your way here?
My husband imported me. That's the short answer.
Where's your husband from?
He's French, but he was living here for a long time and he had the American citizenship.
Nice. Did you meet him here?
No, I met him in Romania.
Oh, okay. All right. Very nice. And did you guys found your company in the US or in Romania?
So the company we started together in 2016, and he was a serial entrepreneur. So he started many companies. Some of them went bankrupt. Some of them did well. And he said, you know, with this talent that you have in product, you should start a company. You should try to start a company with me. And he kept insisting and insisting and insisting. And eventually I said, fine, I'll do it, but only if I'm the CEO.
Nice. So how did Chili Piper come to be? Like, why that business?
I didn't quite know what we will do. Like, I didn't have like a master plan like most entrepreneurs. I just knew that I loved building things, and especially my brain works best when the complexities of the software are hard to crack. In this case, enterprise software is really, really complicated to figure it out. And I was seeing at the time I was working with Oracle, I was working with Salesforce, and I felt, you know, in B2B, software is usually boring. I don't want to build boring software, but I want to see if I can use my B2C kind of talent and apply it to the boring software. And I was just curious. I really was just curious to see what can be done and if I can use my talent there.
And what do you think the biggest kind of like technical challenges have you helped overcome in that space using your B2C minded brain?
I literally went and I applied principles from B2C buying experience into the B2B world and made sure that when we want something as consumers, we press a button on Amazon Prime in 3 seconds is at our door. And in B2B is a lot more complicated. You go to somebody's website, you have to figure out who you're supposed to talk to, you have to wait for them. On the seller side, there's a buying group, which is harder to wrangle and then move towards the right parts of the funnel. So it's a lot more complicated. And I figured that there's a way to improve that buying experience. And that's that there are still a lot of things that can be improved. Even 9 years into it, I still think that there are a million ways to improve it.
For sure. I mean, I have an example just from this week. I am evaluating some vendors for some software that I want. And one of the vendors, I was able to get a demo immediately. Great. The other one, I've I just want a demo, you know, I just want to see it so that I can evaluate. And I haven't been able to get an email back. And it's like, I just want to see the damn product, you know, I don't want to wait. I don't even want to talk to somebody. I just want to play with it myself, you know, and instead I have to wait. Am I going to be able to talk to somebody? I don't know. It's like, I'm going to end up abandoning even seeing that product just because it's this whole long process and dance and whatever. And I just want to maybe buy the product, but no, it's a whole thing. But I totally
agree.
I'll have
to call them after our conversation to make sure that they buy Tilly Piper.
Seriously, I know. I'm going to be like, hey, I've got somebody for you. Maybe improve your buying process. But I feel the same way actually about marketing in B2B. Like, I think the way that people market B2B products is this like very stiff whatever, and it doesn't need to be. We can do consumer marketing. We can take principles from consumer marketing and use that in B2B marketing. You know, we can have a more human-centric marketing. I don't know what the word I'm looking for is, but the way that we talk to people doesn't need to be this very like business stuffy thing that we've always done. I don't know, the enterprise voice that we're used to. I'm so over it. And I wish that more enterprises would take a lesson from the consumer brands that are just having more fun with their marketing, you know. I think we could all learn that.
100% agree with you.
So you have described yourself as a miserable employee. What are red flags that told you that you needed to build your own thing?
A couple of things. One is I love traveling and I couldn't stand being stuck in one location under a neon light without any access to nature or any of those things. I think that when you're more of a creative type and you get your ideas when you walk or when you're changing environment, it's a lot more conducive to better work. The second one was related to decision making in large corporations. You get to climb the ladder if you really get good at politics, and I started getting good at that, but I didn't like that was the case. I felt that there has to be a better way where talent is the one that gets at the top, and that's what I'm aiming to do at Chili Piper as well, where all decisions are transparent. Everyone can make a decision that changes the business. Anyone can contribute. It doesn't matter where you are in the ladder, and everything is transparent, so everybody sees everything. And it's one big experiment, but I do believe that it's a lot more. It's a better system in which everybody feels like they're contributing, as opposed to just people who are louder or who are more astute from a political standpoint.
For sure. I mean, oftentimes the quiet, thoughtful people are the ones who don't have their voices heard, but are the ones who have like super important perspectives. But how are you fostering that culture and making sure that those quieter voices are having their voices heard as part of this?
We have it's actually documented it in a Notion doc, because all my CEO friends ask me about how we make decisions, because it's very unusual, and we have this thing, we call it a decision memo. So it's a Google doc, and we have thousands of such documents, and everyone can create a decision about anything. Could be our pricing, could be who we're going after, so our segments, our ICP, could be what's the right org structure for their particular team. So they start with a problem statement, and then they start why they need to fix that problem now, and then potential options on how to solve that problem. And those documents, nobody in the company can make a decision without starting such a document. And those documents are open to anyone. Anyone can contribute with options and thoughts. For each one of these decisions, we have what's called a consensus caller. So it's not that it's a vote, but everybody gets input back into the decision. And then there's a consensus that needs to happen. So if you have voices that are completely against the solution, then you have to make sure that their view is respected and that you include their data, et cetera, so that the decision can move in the best direction. And we have deadlines, because otherwise the decision can stall forever. Yeah. And you can put like a 2-hour deadline or 30 minutes deadline, like a few days deadline. And we've got used to documenting everything, rationalizing everything, and seeing more options than maybe it's possible at the first glance.
That's super interesting. Do you, when you bring new employees on, how do you like onboard them into this system?
At the beginning, it's very overwhelming because you have all sorts of decisions kind of flying everywhere all the time, and you feel like things are moving very fast. But after a while, they get used to it and they contribute and they can start their own decision making. And it's very empowering because usually you join a company and you feel like you're just a cog in the machine. And at Chili Pepper, everybody takes like ownership over things. And not everybody survives. Not everybody survives. But those that do are very resilient and action oriented.
How large is Chili Pepper? How many people?
So we're in 38 countries, and so that's why the decision-making process has to be written. We're in different time zones, and we're very different culturally, and that's kind of the beauty of it. Right now, we have 140 employees that are human, and then thousands of AI agents.
That's I like that you couched it like that, that you have the human employees and then you have your agents as well. And do you have humans running the agents?
We have agents running the humans.
You have agents.
It's all included.
Where do you have the AI? What parts of your business do you have AI most? Where are the agents most automating, I guess, right now? What part of the business?
It's a lot on the GTM functions. I actually wrote another Notion doc exactly with examples of all the AI agents that we've built.
Really? Can you share it? Is it shareable or is it an internal
doc? I can share both Notions. Yeah. No.
I would love to keep
updating them, yeah. We have a Slack channels where everybody can build agents. And it's actually part of the promotion process. If you want to get promoted at Chili Pepper, you have to show that you've built agents, that you're innovative, that you're thinking about how to improve productivity. And anybody can volunteer. Anybody can volunteer for ideas. And it's very organic and a little bit chaotic, but it's also fun.
I love that, though, because, you know, if you work somewhere that the AI is just not in the DNA of the company, and you'd start like, if I were to start building agents or a team at a company were to start building agents and you were to start saying, this is how people are getting promoted, or this is a way that is, this is a path towards promotion. It really does create, I don't know, it gives people something that they can tangibly do that's adding value to the business that they can go do and learn on their own. That isn't something they don't have to go take a class, right? They don't have to go take a leadership course, or they don't have to hope that their boss is going to give them a promotion because they've hit some, you know, maybe they hit a goal that is potentially tangible or intangible. It's like there are some real things that you're saying. These are value adds to the business, and all of the people are going and doing it. And like you said, it creates this kind of organic movement of people adding value for each other, and everybody's learning from it. It's not just like, oh, I did one thing that's creating a better process. Like everybody is learning how to be better at their jobs, and then they'll be better at their jobs in their next job too, right? Because they're all learning how to build a better plane, I guess, for lack of a better analogy.
And we all learn a lot better by doing than by reading about it, you know? So it's a lot more actionable.
Totally. I would love to see all of the ways that you're using AI in your go-to-market. Can you share a couple examples? Like what are some interesting or like maybe some recent examples of automation that you've done in your go-to-market motions?
So we have something unusual in that we push all our data from our Salesforce, from our marketing automation, and from our product all in one place. We use Snowflake. And as a result, we can make a lot of inferences around what makes for a great customer, what makes for a great customer that sticks, what are the characteristics. And we always feedback that back to the top of the funnel, to the accounts that we target. So there are a lot of data components that we gather with AI agents to make sure that the scoring is correct and that it keeps evolving with the right kind of accounts. And right now, something that I'm working on is making sure that We have a lot of partners, so we work with a lot of agencies, and we work a lot with a lot of product partners as well. Whenever in our ecosystem there are new prospects or new customers, make sure that they are nurtured, like the right buyer in the right company is nurtured with them understanding how like Chili Piper and Gong work together, or Chili Piper and G2 work together. And that also happens with AI agents, because we identify which persona could be best suited for a nurture campaign, and we automate the process like with evergreen automatic campaigns as well on that front. That's something that I'm working on myself right now.
That's very cool. I really want to see your Notion. I'm particularly interested right now. It just feels like every day I see some new go-to-market use case that somebody's doing. Some, you know, CMO is coming up with an interesting way of automating a different part of go-to-market. And so I love that people are starting to create lists of this, and I'm eager to start taking, I don't know, smart people classes, because I'm not nearly as smart as other people that are figuring this out.
We're all trying to figure it out, Becca. We're all trying to figure it out.
But I actually think that's the beauty of right now is I see people online who are like, take my course, I'm an expert. And I'm like, you're a liar. Nobody's an expert right now. Literally nobody. And that's why it's so beautiful right now, because nobody knows what they're doing. And everyone is just trying to figure it out. And in 2 years, we're going to look back and be like, wow, we had no idea what we were doing. But like, the people who are playing with it right now are going to be the ones who are experts in 5 years, just because they're tinkering, right? We're trying to figure it out. We're like getting into the weeds and starting to learn how the pieces fit together. And I don't know. I think it's as a like, I'm not nearly as big of like a tech nerd as you are, but like, I like getting into the like, how does it work part of it, not just into the put an input in, get an input out piece of it, because it helps me, I guess, with my process. So I love this space. So let me ask you, since I found you on LinkedIn, I will pivot there a little bit. How did you start LinkedIn-ing and building your LinkedIn presence? And was that just kind of an organic thing? Like you just like it? Or was that a business decision? Tell me about that.
I very much like 3 years or 4 years ago, I was your typical tech founder that would avoid eye contact and would not want to be in front of press or in front of journalists or anything.
Really?
Very much so. I was terrified of any kind of being on stages or anything like that. First, I felt like my English was awkward. Second, I felt like the words that I was using were limited. I just didn't feel like I had anything to say, really. So as a result, I was just terrified of social media until I decided that I'm just going to force myself. I'm going to force myself and just feel comfortable with pressing the publish button until just that felt less terrifying. And I learned a lot more by just posting every day and feeling uncomfortable than I did from reading any other books on communication on social media. Until I finally found my voice, and I finally found the courage, but it took about 12 months or so, every day posting.
I feel like I want to just like clip that clip right there, because that is like the perfect, like, I don't know, 30, 60 seconds of everyone I ever try to convince to start posting on LinkedIn. They give me the whole like, yeah, but like, you're so comfortable writing or showing up on camera or whatever. And I'm like, no, like I'm a comms lady. I'm a behind the scenes comms lady. Like, I don't like being on camera. I don't like doing podcasts. Like, I never liked doing this stuff. I think LinkedIn is cringy too, or I used to think LinkedIn is cringy, but like, to your point, you just have to start, right? Like, there is a reason to do it. We all know that there is a benefit to being out there and doing it. So once you start doing it, it becomes a little bit easier, and it becomes a little bit easier, and you get positive back in, like, right? People start to reflect back to you that people are getting something out of it when you are putting something out there. And when you start to hear from them, oh, I'm getting value out of what you're putting out there, that's giving you the courage to do more of that. And then you start to realize, I don't have to be some polished, perfect, whatever. They like the flawed version, or they like the, you know, I am, they like the immigrant story, right? Or they like the tech founder story, or they like whatever version of you you were worried to share in the first place. And I just think that people need to get past the worry about cringe and just start doing it, because after 12 months, there you are. Suddenly you are full of courage and full of new communication skills and poised in a way that you never thought you would be. And I never would have guessed that you were not comfortable doing this, because you seem like such a natural and like a content creator at heart online. To me, I thought you were like all in on all of that. Seriously.
No. Just posting every day was the best writing course. And right now I do find joy in it. Right now I actually enjoy it. But yeah, I was completely terrified. And now it's more automatic. One thing that helped me a lot at the beginning was, and I don't know how I came up with it. I don't think I read it anywhere. I came up with it and it helped me a lot, was to imagine myself a few years back and just write to myself. And I knew myself pretty well, and I would know that I don't like to read fluffy things, egocentric things, more things that would have been helpful to me in that stage of my life. And that made it a lot easier. It felt like I was writing letters to myself.
That is such good advice. And I also tell people, like, when I write, like, pick one person to write to. Like you said, like, you're writing to your former self. I would write to somebody on my team, right? Like, if I'm writing to somebody who needs advice from a leader, there you go. That's a person, not to the entire world. Do you write all of your own content?
Yes, I've never had anybody editing or write help me with content.
And
I don't know if it was a good idea or not.
No, it's totally authentic. That's why it works, really, truly. But, you know, I always ask CEOs. I've spent my career writing content for CEOs, so I'm always curious. When CEOs do their own content, I think it's such an interesting, it takes time, right? Content is a labor of love. Do you use AI to create content?
So here's my process. Is very, very strange. Every evening when I put my kids to sleep around 8 o'clock, I sometimes fall asleep with them and I don't have any content. Or if I don't fall asleep, then I just think about something that has happened in that day and write it in my Apple Notes. And then in the morning, I reread, because I have like an ongoing set of notes, which one feels more alive in me that particular morning. And I just take my notes and I post it.
Your process is almost exactly the same as mine. Almost exactly the same. I have an ongoing Apple note that is just like full of random ideas. I call them my shower thoughts, because it's like they come at the most inopportune times when I can't write a whole post. So I'll just like throw some of my thoughts in there, and then I'll go scroll through them and be like, which one can I build out the rest of the ideas around right now? And then I'll post it. So that's funny. I love that. How old are your kids?
They're 6 and 4.
Okay. Yeah. I have a 10 and 8-year-old, so I'm just ahead of you, but 6 and 4, you're still in the young era. Fun. I don't know how you do it as a CEO. I'm hanging on.
I don't know either. Just complete chaos at all times.
That's how you do it. It's just chaos at all times, all the time.
Right. Embracing it. Yeah.
Well, okay, so that actually brings me to another question. Like, as a founder, and your husband, also a founder and CEO, co-CEO, is there ever like moments where you're just like, this isn't going to work? Like, what are we, like, we can't do this? You know, like, what have we gotten ourselves into? Do you ever feel like that?
In my case, it's a little bit different, because unlike other, I think that I talk to a lot of founders, and in our case, because we had a beautiful exit cash-wise, I don't feel like the pressure of finances or anything like that. And I just focus on the joy of building. And he loves it a lot as well. We can't imagine doing anything else. So I think I'm going to do this until I'm 150 years old, which I know sounds weird, but I really, really like it. So
That's the dream, right? Is like finding the thing that you love to do so much that you just want to do it forever. That Mm-hmm. It doesn't sound weird. That sounds ideal. So good on you. Mm-hmm. Congratulations for finding that thing in life.
I'm happy I found what brings me the joy. Yeah.
For real, though, especially when you are grinding in it, but you still love it, right? Like, I think that's when you know that you found the thing that you love, is when you can, when you have to grind sometimes to the point that you're like exhausted and are giving up things in your life that you also love, but you're still doing it because you love to do it. That's the joy.
I do want to caution, because I don't want to sound not in touch with reality. It's hard. Like, I have roller coasters every day, and they're like hard things happening every day that take me down and make me doubt on my capacity to handle it all. But even when those hard moments come, I just know that it's a signal that I'm learning something new, and it's a painful moment, but I'm learning something. So I approach it with curiosity. It is a roller coaster with emotional ups and downs. But I still lean in with curiosity even when it's hard.
Well, yeah, and it's worth it for you, right? Because like you said, like, it brings you joy and it's fulfilling. So again, it's like at the end of the day, that's what matters. So what is the future of Chili Piper? You know, if you had your magic eight ball, like, what's the next 5 years?
So as I was telling you, for me, it's one big experiment. I wonder if we can make this company work where everybody's thriving and everybody has as much fun as me and my co-founder in it. And we try to get the employees that find that, where they love working remote on hard problems, and it's their passion that they're working on, and that they're growing and thriving. That's like my main priority. And then, of course, on the revenue front, we want to... in 5 years, probably like 400 million in AR or so, and employ as many happy employees as we can doing cool things in the agent orchestration space. Right now we're focusing on marketing, and it's a lot of fun.
That's so cool. Well, okay. So this is a communications podcast, and what you're doing internally with your culture, this experiment that you talk about, is like an internal communications case study in the making. Like, this is an amazing thing that you're doing. So my first question is, do you have an internal communications person at your company who is helping you manage all of this, or who is doing internal communications? Does that come from you?
It's very funny, but I have a Notion doc.
The Notion doc is your internal communications person.
No, I have a Notion doc that explains how we do this kind of stuff as well, because our culture is very unusual. We're very flat. So there's no need for an executive to communicate something, because we're all kind of working together. And we kind of, our roles are quite fluid as well. So our alignment is fluid. And I wrote about it in the culture doc, in the Notion culture doc, on how we kind of make it work, because it's kind of... It's unusual. We spend tons of time on training, because of on communication specifically, because we believe that, very much so, we believe that the reasons why companies break is because of lack of communication, and also because there's conflict. And when conflict is uncomfortable, most people choose not to go and have a different opinion or butt heads. And we kind of... eliminated that because we do the decision memos, but there's still people that have a very strong opposing voice, and you still want to make sure that that they feel heard and that everybody's understood and everybody kind of understand the different points of view. So we do tons of training on it, tons of it.
What does that training look like?
It is based off of a book. So you probably heard of it. It's Marshall Rosenberg wrote a book that's called Nonviolent Communication. It's one of like best-selling, and he left behind him a nonprofit that also helps with nonviolent communication. Not that we're all violent in our words, but more helping with conflict of opinion, difference of opinions. And we have their coaches that are part of that foundation kind of coming with us and helping us with the systems, also helping us with the groups. Even though we're remote, we do these trainings in person. We find that it's a lot more productive, and quarterly we get together and train our team on trust building, on connection, conflict management and all of those things.
I love this. I mean, I really do. You know, I've talked to a lot of companies and I've seen a lot of cultures, and I could not agree with you more that the breakdown of culture comes from communication breakdown, lack of trust, lack of psychological safety, lack of empowerment. And you are head on addressing those specific issues before people even get into their roles. You are literally like, hi, day one, welcome to the company. We're going to train you on how to mitigate these problems. Oh, and also we're going to empower you with this decision-making process that we have. Oh, and by the way, we're a flat organization, so your opinion matters. And, you know, if you need to, you know, talk to the people you need to talk to, you're able to talk to them. Like, this is it's an important, I think, experiment that you're running. And frankly, I think I would be very interested to see the results in a couple of years to see, you know, as you scale, as you become a 500 person company, 1,000 person company, 5,000 person company, how these processes start to, you know, how they stretch, how they start to change or evolve as more people come into the mix. Do you think, you know, does that scare you? Does that excite you? Like, what do you think about that?
The scaling question is one that's on my mind a lot, because I'm building out of AI agents and I just don't know what they're like, how far the AI agents can go on what a human can do. And I actually wrote, I was invited at Oracle 2 days ago to do a speech around AI agents in the org chart, because Midjourney is at 300 million with 60 employees. Cursor has 30 employees and they're also, I don't know, like 60 million now in AR. And like, companies need less and less headcount. And on one side, that's terrifying, because what does that even look like? Like, where are humans kind of playing in that ecosystem? On the other side, I think there are a lot of exciting outcomes from it. I think that the companies will get smaller, but we will have more companies in the ecosystem. So I think that a lot more people will start their own companies. They will not have to be bogged down with like a overhead with having 100 people to work for them. And they will just like administer the orchestration of agents and so forth. It's just so hard to predict what the world is going to look like with this kind of new structure in place.
And I think a lot about how I would very much not want to be like a 22-year-old straight out of college right now, because like, on the one hand, yeah, it's exciting. Everything's new and you have an opportunity to kind of shape the next trend. But on the other hand, it's like, how do you even decide what to do, knowing that all of the skills that you've just acquired over the last 4 years might be completely meaningless in 2 years? I don't know. It's such a weird, weird place to be in the world right now. Like, at least with us, like, we have years of experience, work experience that matters, right? Like, the experience counts for something. New grads are like, they don't have experience, and the future, I don't know. It's such a weird time. Like you said, we can't predict what's coming, and I don't even know.
It's definitely on my mind for my kiddos to prepare them for real life. And it's hard to pick the type of things we put emphasis on. But I still get back to teaching them how to build trust and how to learn to create their own compass of wisdom that allows them to kind of pivot and adapt, because the only thing that's certain is that everything will be uncertain ahead of them.
Totally. I've decided that the only thing that matters is being a good person and being adaptable. So those are the things in life that we can control, right? Okay, well, I'm going to go to our rapid fire questions since we're getting close to time. So let me pull these up.
Okay.
All right. So first rapid fire question. What is a myth or misconception about marketing or communications that drives you crazy?
Well, when I started working in large corporations, I thought that I would only get good at communication if I read a lot of books on it and I learned to use fancy words. Turns out the opposite was true. I don't need to use any fancy words, and all I have to do is keep practicing. So Yeah.
Very true. I actually think people who use fancy words tend to sound like they're just trying to overcompensate for not really being great communicators. So yeah, that's funny.
Not saying much. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. You get to erase one corporate buzzword from existence. What is it?
So it's not a word, but it's a structure that I see a lot and I hate it. And it says, in today's fast-paced world, that's something that I hate.
Well, it's the AI speak, right? It's like the beginning of every AI sentence. In today's blah, blah, blah. In today's evolving blah, blah. Yeah, totally agree. And every time I see it now, I'll just immediately like ignore whatever comes after.
Dismiss it.
Totally. Okay. You're about to give a presentation in front of 50,000 people, and maybe you've actually done this before. What is your walkout song?
They never ask me what walkout sound I want. I do speak a lot, but I would love to have the, she's got it, that baby, she's got it.
Oh, that's a good one. I'm your Venus. Yeah, that one.
The one.
Nice. I like that one. And they don't ask you what song you want?
They don't put the song. I don't know why. And I've spoke so many times and I never get the song.
Well, if you're ever at one of my conferences, you can pick your walkout song. There you go. And you can pick your walk-off song too. So really you could have two songs. Okay. Speaking of speaking, if you had to do a TED Talk on anything but marketing or communications, what would your topic be?
Well, I think I'm going to do a TED Talk soon. And my topic for sure, it would be around rebranding happiness, how a mom who built a $1 billion company hacks joy at scale.
Talk a little bit more about that. I want to hear more.
So it's, I'm writing now my biography and my book. And that's kind of been my theme throughout, is how to find joy in everything that I do. And in the worst possible circumstances, I've had a super weird upbringing, and how that lift me up from what I was told that I can do or can't do. So it's a topic that's dear to my heart.
Okay,
so like nobody tells you that a woman with two kids can run a company, that the tech company, and nobody tells you that a kid that had nothing to eat as a child can build, come to us and do all these crazy things. So I just don't believe in limitations. I believe in finding joy.
So what's like one tip you would give to somebody to help them find joy in everyday moments?
It's complicated because I'm writing an entire book around it. But if I were just to sum it up to one thing, it would be to find self-compassion. A lot more self-love and self-compassion.
I could not agree more. I always talk about how like my biggest gift to myself was giving myself more grace to just like be, right? Like we are humans and self-compassion is such an important part of who we are. If we don't have compassion for ourselves, why would we expect other people to have compassion for us? So I love that. And I can't wait to read your biography. So what's the timing on that? When are you planning to finish writing it?
I wrote it, but I'm just afraid to publish it. And I think that my fear on publishing comes from the fact that I've never written a book. I've never written anything. I've only started writing 2 years ago. And I wonder if I let it maturate for one more year, can I make it better? So that's where
I would be
I'm
happy to
right
read
now.
A draft if you want somebody to give you an opinion. Seriously.
You don't have to insist. You don't have to insist.
I would love to, but if you want an unfiltered opinion, I have no filter and I would be happy to share my thoughts. So just putting that out
best,
there.
That's the best type of communication, the one where you don't hold anything back.
I do not have the ability to hold things back. Unfortunately, that is both a flaw and a good thing about me, I guess.
I know what that looks like. Yeah. I have the same problem, so I know.
My mom used to joke that, like, if you wanted to find out, you know, if the neighbors have something going on, it's like, just send Becca in. She'll find out all of the information because I have no filter and I will ask all of the inappropriate questions. But, you know, it's a good thing. Okay, two more questions. You get to use one emoji for the rest of your life. Which one?
It's the thinking one. That's what I use all the time because I'm always in deep thought. Yeah.
That one. I feel like there's two thinking ones. There's that one, and then there's like the monocle. No, there's like a...
The monocle one. It's the monocle. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yep. I like the thinking one. I use that one frequently. Okay.
But I think we can't use emojis anymore because then people will think that we wrote it with AI. So I don't think we can use emojis.
I use them all the time. And M dashes and Oxford commas. Everyone be damned. I refuse to let AI ruin my writing. AI has stolen my writing style, not the other way around.
I think that's the case, yeah.
That is totally the case. I take offense by everybody mocking the AI. Actually, I wrote about this today. What it really comes down to is people who have pattern recognition can recognize AI writing because of the patterns. It's not the M dashes or the emojis. It's the like the cadence of the writing. But
it's the cadence.
People who don't recognize patterns in the same way need to have the tells, right? They need to know it's the M dashes, it's the emojis, it's the commas. But really, it's not those things. It's the cadence and the patterns.
The whole thing, yeah.
Wax on about this all day, but I will not. I will ask you Perry's unhinged question in the absence of Perry, because this is the question that we ask everybody at the end of our show. But I will caveat this with this Perry's unhinged question, which is, you can either have hiccups 24/7 for 3 months. So while you're sleeping, while you're eating, while you're trying to work, hiccuping nonstop, or you can chop off your own pinky. Either pinky, your choice.
So the hiccuping is super pleasant, but it goes away. And it kind of reminds me from when I was pregnant and I was always awake at all times because I felt like all sorts of things were happening inside of my body. So I lived through it. I know I can do it. It ends, and then I keep my fingers.
Perry would be so happy that you said that. He would be like, see, I told you, Becca. See, Alita's not crazy. Because I would cut off my pinky. There you go. I'm the unhinged nuts one who would cut off my pinky. And I will say it's because I have had hiccups for multiple days at a time and it really hurts and I cannot sleep and I would lose my mind after 3 months of having hiccups and I would have jumped off a bridge at that point. And so by that point, who needs a pinky if you've already jumped off a bridge? So there you go.
That's true.
Okay. Before we sign off, I would love to give you an opportunity. Is there anything that you would like to share, pitch, whatever, send people to before we log off for the day?
I don't have any pitches, but I do have a deep desire to help with all my crazy experiments, because whenever I share the type of things that I'm working on, someone always gives me feedback on what's working and what's not working, and that's my best way of learning. So I do have Notion docs around all the things that I've spoken about, and also around how we do our strategy for social media and deeper into my process for writing. And I can share all of that with you and we can put it in the description and maybe it helps someone.
I would love that. So yes, please share with me and audience. I will add the links into the show notes so that you can go see Alina's jillions of Notions, because she is apparently the Notion queen, and I am super excited to dig into these myself because I think we all have a lot to learn here. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Sorry.
Thank you, Becca. And for those that are listening and do not see like in YouTube, if you come find me on LinkedIn, I have it on at the top of my profile. It says visit my website and it goes deep into my Notions as well. So if you're listening and you don't have the link, there's that option as well.
There you go. Thank you so much. It's been great having you.
Thank you, Becca. It was a pleasure.